Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Gilbertson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Carlisle Schleem and the Farmer State Bank of Canton Appellants versus the State of South Dakota Department of Transportation, Appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Mark Meyer-Henry, and then also we'll have Mr. Clint Sargent and Mr. Christopher Healy, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Meyer-Henry, I understand you'll be presenting this morning.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And for the state, we have Ms. Carol Engel. With that, we may proceed. And you have 20 minutes, Mr. Meyer-Henry.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. This is an appeal from a summary judgment. The trial court granted summary judgment in this case and issued a memorandum opinion. There's no findings of facts to talk about. There's no true conclusions of law in the normal sense to talk about. What happened in this case, procedurally, very basically, is the plaintiff filed a complaint and alleged that all economically viable access to Mr. Schleem's property had been taken as a result of the project, which this court's aware of. We've had two cases about Northside Gardens already. They're pending before your honors.
Are there any more coming?
Yes, there could be.
Okay.
There's one more pending, Your Honor. Justice Wilbur, that's a little different because it has to do with water rushing off the interstate and from a road we'll probably talk about today. So there's one more. The state responded, not with an answer, but with a motion alleging or a motion for failure to state a claim. And so a hearing was held on that motion to state a claim. And the circuit court judge told the parties that he was going to turn that into a summary judgment motion and allowed the plaintiffs 90 days to obtain more evidence.
Was an answer ever filed?
Yes, I think an answer was subsequently filed. I guess I can't remember for sure, but it was a denial of any responsibility. Here's what this argument's about today. This is, in a way, a Hall 1 argument of a rush to judgment. There is no full record to review. What there was no depositions taken by either party. There was no testimony in front of the circuit court judge. All of the evidence, such that it is, has come in by affidavits from the state and affidavits from the plaintiff. The affidavit of the state and the evidence of the state is basically attached to their brief and is a series of maps and a affidavit by Mr. Lieferman that goes into the fact that there was no legal action against this property and basically lays out distances and so forth of a alleged alternative access that was put up by the state as a part of the project. There is really no evidence that was presented by the plaintiff found in the memorandum decision. It's not discussed and it's not analyzed.
Well, the amount of property your client had before the action started, he still has, correct?
That's correct. The problem is, and it's not found in the memorandum decision and it's not analyzed by the court, is that the evidence presented by the plaintiff is that same property that before this project was valuable and had commercial access after the project is now vacant lot and is not economically suitable for any development. If this court were to get in a car and go down and look at this property today in Northside Gardens, you will find there has been no improvement in the 5 years that this cases have been going on. The evidence from the plaintiff's side of the case, never mentioned, never analyzed, is that for the foreseeable future, this property, the access is so deficient to the Schleem property that its only use is to hold on to the property, hoping that sometime in the future, changes may allow it to economically be developed. That's not discussed. Why are all these facts important? The law here isn't in flux. It isn't that we have to do anything that this court didn't do in Darnell and Hurley and Rupert and so forth. What has to be done, this court has told the circuit judges, is you have to have a full investigation of the facts before you can start applying law to it. That's what this court found in Hall. And you've had two cases on Hall. And so here what we're arguing in this summary judgment is to send this case back and allow the facts to be determined and do exactly what this court has told circuit judges to do, which is to get the facts and then analyze it and determine first, has the access been unreasonably changed? The state's evidence, they have no one who testifies that it's what the condition of the access was before and after, except as to distances.
Isn't that a question of law, though? I mean, in Cryer, we determined it as a matter of law. And I don't see you objecting to the findings or to the facts. You don't allege there's a material dispute of fact, as I understand it. You're just arguing the court didn't go through the Hall analysis. But if it's a question of law, why does it need to go back for that?
But what is, I guess I would ask the court, how can this court determine whether the lower court determined as to reasonableness on unreasonableness? The summary judgment standard, are there facts that run into each other that allow for a trial? Here, the court made basically in its memorandum decision.
But the trial would be to the court, because the first thing that has to be established is whether there was a constitutional damaging or taking sufficient to warrant compensation. And that we've always said that's a question of law, haven't we?
But let's look at the law that has to be considered.
Okay.
It's you take the access, in this case, the access before, which was reasonable and valuable to this property. What was the access of this property before? The access of this property before was onto 63rd Street, but then onto Cliff Avenue. The access onto 63rd Street is of no value if it doesn't go someplace. It went onto 63rd Street. Okay? Not analyzed by the circuit court is all of those other properties between the Slim property and the 63rd Street access were considered commercial properties by the market. And the evidence in the record by the market were all high-end commercial properties of great value. Okay? I'm still applying the law, because the first thing is the reasonableness after. All right? So before, this court has already heard about Northside Gardens. In this record, by affidavit, is Brenda Smith's testimony. There would be a Kelly Inn and all the surrounding development done now, but for this project. That's evidence of reasonableness of access before. Now, after, not discussed, after, what's the access? There are three important people whose appraisals were attached by an affidavit and put into the record to talk about, is there reasonable access afterwards? All three, one hired by the state, their expert. One hired by the plaintiff. One hired by the bank, who is a plaintiff, but not for this case, for regular banking business. What do they say? Mr. Smith, a name familiar with this court, found that as a result, now he's talking about other property, but part of the assemblage of the, would be part of the assemblage of this property, Your Honor. And I'm saying, as a matter of law, this is what we have to determine, the reasonableness before and after of whether it's a police power or whether it's a damaging, because this is a damaging case, not a taking case, damaging case. If you read from The evidence and the affidavit, the Schmidt appraisal at page 41, I think it's page 140 of the settled record, he finds that with the closure of 63rd Street, Northside Gardens loses all commercial access. Okay? So in the after, there's no commercial access. It is agreed to by Kayschmitter, who says the best thing to do is level it and let it sit. No commercial value of any type, residential, commercial, whatever. Miller, for the plaintiff, testifies to the same. All of the evidence is this property has been damaged at least $250,000. Never mentioned by the circuit court. Back to your point, Your Honor, which is exactly the point we agree with. It's a matter of law. But how do you get there? You first of all get there by saying there was reasonable access before. Is there reasonable access after? If the access after of the Slim property is such that it does not support any use of that property except as vacant, that's unreasonable. Therefore, it's a damaging case.
So my question is procedural. Why aren't you arguing that to us as a matter of law? Why are you asking us to send this back to the circuit court? Because if it's a question of law, it doesn't really matter what how the circuit court analyzed it.
Well, it's because, Your Honor, with respect to the circuit court, we have a lot more evidence than what you're looking at here.
But you didn't make that point objecting to summary judgment. You didn't say there's a dispute of fact about something and summary judgment was improperly granted. You're arguing it merely as a matter of law, strictly as a matter of law, aren't you? Or am I misunderstanding?
We're arguing that there are material facts, okay?
In dispute?
In dispute. The trial court doesn't recognize.
I didn't understand that.
I mean, maybe I don't understand it, Your Honor, but clearly the trial court, if you read the trial court's memorandum, it's never mentioned any of the evidence for the plaintiff. None.
That's because it looks to be like the trial court looked at Darnell and just said case over.
Right, but if that's the case, this court has been clear on that. This is more, this case is not a Darnell case. And not only that, what this court has said over and over again is the first thing is you look at this reasonableness. All right? Reasonable and unreasonable. When we went into this case, the allegations in the complaint are that there is no economically viable access to this property after the project. You can see what the state did. The state says, well, we label this a security of travel case, non-compensable. All right? How do you get there? Well, you label it. I submit perhaps that's what Judge Long did. I don't know. But in this case, we have all people under the Constitution have a right to a trial, whether it's a run-of-the-mill civil case or whatever. This court has said over and over again, if there are diametrically opposed facts, there are ultimate facts.
Court trial or jury trial? What do you want?
We want a court trial because okay. I'd prefer a jury trial, but we get a court trial. That's what this court said. That's step one, the court trial. Then if we win that, after a full investigation of all the facts, and the court decides that it's unreasonable, and we pass the consequential injury part of Rupert, we win. Well, here, we haven't made those arguments yet because we went first to a motion that we didn't state a cause of action, and then to a summary judgment, and in the record we're submitting to this court, there's more than enough facts for a trial. There should not have been a summary judgment. There wasn't a decision here. There was a summary judgment. I mean, I'm misstating. There was a memorandum decision. But there wasn't the true. I'm not here saying at page 22 of the transcript. And I'm not here saying the testimony was. I'm saying the testimony, so to speak, attached to the affidavit. And so we're here like in Hall to ask that the court do its job that this court told it to do, which is collect all the relevant evidence, then analyze it under the constitutional standard as a matter of law, whether there has been substantial impairment of the access, whether there have been substantial impairment of the right of joining with your neighbors.
That's what it all comes down to in this case, it seems to me.
Here's what it comes down to.
Was there substantial impairment?
Exactly. And that's what you get a trial for, and that's where the facts are running into it. As part of this, let's explain this property a bit more. And again, we're here on summary judgment. All of the people knowledgeable about this land know one thing. This is a unique situation. In the before, with the access of 63rd Street onto Cliff by the market, it was considered to be hot property. That's important in this case because there has to be $500,000, state's witness, $500,000 or more of upgrades to make 63rd Street a legal street. So in the before and the after, there has to be improvements in order to build on any of these lots. You've heard about these lots. There's no building on them. There's not going to be any building on them. Because before you can get a building permit from the city of Sioux Falls, you have to have access to a legal street, meaning any party that wants to improve their property in Northside Gardens today has to spend, they and their neighbors, $500,000 or more to have a street to improve their property. In the before, everyone was excited because we could do it. We could improve our property. We could join with our neighbors. Not only would we get a legal 63rd Street, we would be able, because of the commercial uses of the property and the access of the slim property to the neighboring property, which was also commercial, and across the street was also commercial, all of those properties together could afford to build the infrastructure for the 63rd Street. Okay? That's all been destroyed. All of the evidence from the plaintiff's side says you can't come up with economically viable uses for any of this property, including the slim property, that it can be anything but vacant at the present time under the reasonable, unreasonable test. And there's more evidence that could be put in. But at this point, that's diametrically opposed to the finding of the trial court that the access hasn't changed. Of course it's changed. The slim property cannot develop now. Its access is such, and that's a property right, valuable property right, has been so destroyed, it's basically worthless. If Mr. Slim attempts to sell this property to another party, the other party's going to come and find you're not going to get a building permit because 63rd Street is not a lawful access. So there is no lawful access left.
How do we determine in the future where the line is? Because If there were other properties down 63rd, farther down another, this one's 700 feet or something like that. What about 1,100 feet and then, 1,200 feet and a half mile? How do we work that out?
I'll tell you how you work that out. You have a full trial and you get all the facts. This is tough stuff. This is civil law. And you have to make decisions and you have to get a lot of evidence, and it's a pain in the butt sometimes, Justice Zinner. But there's no sky is falling here. There's no sky is falling. And we don't have to answer your question. We have to answer the question that's here today. Because
2 minutes.
I could give you 1,000 for instances. If this were all residential property, probably not here. There's 1,000 things. Deal with the case that's here. The case that's here that the court didn't deal with is that before we had high-end commercial property, this property was worth, I don't remember exactly, but $300,000, for example. After the project, the access was destroyed, and any possibility of financially ever getting access is gone. In the after, the slim property, the evidence is clear, is vacant. It's going to be vacant forever until things change. But in the law that's on the books now, it's unreasonable. We win that, we get a trial. Well, we get a victory if we can go back and prove our case. So we're here, and I'll sum up. This is a summary judgment. We're not deciding the case. There are definitely conflicting ideas, conflicting facts. And the court rushed the judgment, just like in Hall 1, send it back, we'll try the case, we'll come back. And then we can decide all those issues with a full record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer Henry. Ms. Engel, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court and counsel. This case presents two basic issues. The first issue is, what is the proper legal test to be applied when a landowner complains about loss of a more direct access route to a non-abutting street? And then the second issue is, was that test met? And I would submit to the court that the state prevails on both of those issues. And I want to begin first by talking about the landowner's continued confusion between the rights of an abutting landowner and the rights of a non-abutting landowner, because that is crucial. In South Dakota, as well as in other states such as North Dakota, which Mr. Meyer Henry relies on, the court has recognized that a landowner who abuts a street has certain rights of reasonable access to that street, and that the government's restriction of those rights must be reasonable. If the government goes beyond reasonable restrictions for an abutting street, then the landowner may have a compensable cause of action under the law of eminent domain. But that applies to abutting landowners. And in fact, our court has recognized that abutting landowners have certain special, unique rights in that abutting street. That finding is critical because our court, in cases involving abutting landowners as well as cases involving not abutting landowners, applies what I refer to as the special injury test. The special injury test says that if you want to recover damages in eminent domain, you have to show that you have suffered a peculiar injury to your land that is different in kind and not merely in degree from that sustained by the general public. That is the test that we apply. And with abutting landowners, we look at, did they have reasonable access in the before? Do they have reasonable access in the after? If that answer is no, they don't have reasonable access in the after, but they did in the before, then our court says they may have sustained a special injury because they have special rights in an abutting street. That is not the law for non-abutters. For non-abutters, they have to show a special injury. What does Mr. Meyer Henry offer to you to prove that special injury? It can't be reasonableness. It has to be a special injury. Well, he is very careful to avoid what really happened here. What happened is this landowner had a short route of about 750 feet to go from their property to the Cliff Avenue intersection, which is also very close to the interstate. And that was before the project. After the project, what the state did is we first built an extension of 63rd so that it would connect with streets to the east.
Is it a legal street? It looks like it's an asphalt, piece of asphalt you laid out for X number of yards. He said it's going to cost $500,000 to make that an appropriate legal access.
Well, I'll answer the first question, Justice Kern. Is it a legal street? Yes. Is what he had in the before a legal street? No. In fact, he describes what he has in the before as a dirt path, and that is an accurate description. And it was 33 feet wide, 33 and a half feet, which does not meet city development standards.
Aren't these factual issues?
Those are all undisputed facts, Your Honor. Those facts were in the record.
Doesn't sound undisputed to me today.
Well, what Mr. Meyer Henry and I'd like to get to the second part of your question, Justice Kern, because I believe it goes to your question too, Justice Severson. When he said it was going to cost $500,000 to improve the street, that was in the before. Our appraiser concluded that you'd have to have that much money to improve the street to make it developable. And our appraiser, and I want to talk about the Schmick appraisal, because I think Mr. Meyer-Henry has misconstrued the significance of that appraisal. That appraisal was of the Kelly Inland, which abutted Cliff Avenue. And Kelly Inn represented to our appraiser and also had worked with the city. And Kelly Inn had 60 feet of frontage, if you included 63rd Street plus their frontage. What they were proposing to do for their development was to combine their frontage with 63rd Street to provide legal access for the Kelly Inn. And what our appraiser determined is that the city, not the state, the city was likely to have allowed that. And so he considered what they had in the before as an abutting landowner, what they had in the after, concluded that those access rights as an abutter had been substantially impaired, and he compensated them for that. And they agreed to that. It never went to condemnation.
So what was the DOT's plan? You made offers to lots 2, 3, and 4 and the Kellyanne property and left the rest?
Not exactly the rest, because if you'll recall, we did make an offer to the Kellyanne, settled with them for the value that we had offered for the total value of the property. With Miller and Walsh, there was a slight taking along the ramp to help with drainage along the ramp. And so we offered them the value of what we viewed the taking and damaging to be for that. And their response was, we should be compensated for the loss of the intersection. And we've argued that as non-abutting landowners, they don't have special rights in that intersection. Now the next chapter is the Schlimm property. But I do want to talk about the alternate access that we provided, because it is 66 feet wide. That meets city development standards. It's asphalt, curb, and gutter, two lanes, paved, storm sewer. It's far superior in terms of the physical attributes from what we had at the intersection.
Is that in place now?
Yes. Yes.
Where?
It's to the east of the property.
Oh, but from what street to what street is it completed?
Yes.
I said from what street to what street?
The 63rd Street extension started at 63rd Street, Your Honor, that dirt path. It connects, it's asphalt, curb, and gutter, and it connects to it connects to 63rd, which also intersects right there with National Avenue, and then you can continue down 63rd and you connect with Golby Avenue.
All the maps that are here show those as undeveloped dirt paths.
The maps show what the plans were, Your Honor, but the record demonstrates that we built that extension before we closed the intersection. That was in the affidavit of Mark Leiferman. So the map is included as a depiction of what was planned. That was attached to the condemnation petition, and that was built before we closed the intersection. So they did have alternate usable access before the intersection was closed.
You just have to proceed down Cliff or reach one of these other side streets, mm-hmm. 61st or 60th or
yes.
National.
Yes. Absolutely. One other comment that Mr. Meyer-Henry made to you today that I would like to dispel is he has argued to you today that the property has absolutely no beneficial use. That claim is contradicted by the very evidence he put into the record. If you review the appraisal of Mr. It's pronounced Miller, but it's spelled Mueller, M-U-E-L-L-E-R, he says in the before, the highest and best use of the property was for commercial use. He says in the after, the highest and best use is for industrial use. Same with Mr. Cashmitter, or the Cashmitter firm that appraised the property. They said in the before, it was ideal for commercial use, in the after, the highest and best use as industrial use. There is no one who offered evidence that this property had no use. And he says, well, the only use of it can be vacant. Well, even in the before, the appraiser said that the improvements on the property, that residence, provided no value to the land. And so they even appraised it as though it were vacant because the improvements were actually a detriment. So that's a misstatement that I think needs to be corrected. I'd like to talk about the other ways that the landowner attempts to prove special injury. And they're very careful. I mean, what really happened here, they used to have a direct route to Cliff Avenue. Now, admittedly, it is a more circuitous route if you come from Cliff Avenue. If you're actually coming from the east on 60th, it's shorter. If you're coming from the south, it's a little longer. And they admitted that. We acknowledged that. And that's really what they're complaining about. They talk about loss of commercial viability, loss of commercial access. But what was it that was lost? It was that more direct route. And the cases that they cite to this court acknowledge that that kind of circuity of travel, that's not the kind of injury that leads to compensation in eminent domain.
Though, if you take all use of the property, how far do you have to? I mean, if you here it is adding what, half mile, mile? Mm-hmm. What if you added 10 miles? What if you went out to Brandon before you got it? Are you still saying, hypothetically, there's no taking if you have to run out 10 miles east?
Well, let's look at the union.
Then what's the test? That's my question.
The test is if you can show a special injury. And let's talk about the cases that find.
So circuity of travel doesn't matter if you can show a special interest, is what you're saying.
You have to show that you've really been landlocked, that your access has been obstructed, because circuity of travel alone is not enough. What you have is you have special rights in your abutting street, and then you have a right to be connected to the street system. You do not have a right to dictate what that route looks like.
So if you go to Brandon, that's fine.
That's right. That's right. And
what if you go to Laverne? What if you have to go to Marshall?
What the courts have said, and of course we don't have that situation here, but what the courts have
said
is...
Well, it's a matter of degree of whether or not you have that situation.
Well, you have to have a usable connection to the city streets. So I struggle to understand how we could get you to Brandon and you wouldn't have a connection to the city streets earlier than that. And just on behalf of DOT, we're a very customer service oriented agency. I highly doubt we'd ever do that to a landowner. And that's certainly not what we did here. We actually provided them with superior access, in our view, than what they had in the before.
Well, if it's superior, why did it go from high-end commercial to at best an industrial?
Because that's what the landowner's appraisers concluded. That's not what our appraiser concluded in the Miller and Walsh case. But because we were seeking summary judgment, we didn't even bother to dispute that. We conceded that point for purposes of summary judgment.
How can the trial court make these types of determinations on using a summary judgment standard, whether or not we have a substantial impairment? I mean, on the basis of affidavits, not subject to cross-examination. Are you telling the court that that's the proper procedure? You're comfortable with making these types of determinations based on affidavits?
Yes, and actually, as Justice Zinner pointed out, that's what was done in the Cryer case, if I'm not mistaken. Just because it's eminent domain doesn't mean that summary judgment shouldn't be available when there's no dispute of facts and the government or the landowner is entitled to summary judgment as a matter of law. In fact, Mr. Meyer-Henry neglects to inform the court that he actually sought summary judgment in this case. There were cross motions for summary judgment here. But he failed to come forward with the facts that would support a special injury. What did he come forward with? First, he said, well, my land value has diminished. That must be proof of damage. But the very cases that he has pointed to, asked this court to examine, say proof of damage alone is not sufficient to recover in eminent domain. He points the court to the Girard case out of North Dakota. The Girard case says, the question of whether there has been a taking or damaging of private property for public use is a question of law. There is not simply a question as to whether damage has occurred, but it is a question as to whether the damage is of a type which is compensable. We start with the basic proposition that some actions of government agencies which incidentally affect private property do not give rise to a right to damages. That's the very case that he's urging you to consider. The other argument that he makes, besides just, well, there was this loss of viable commercial access, which is really a complaint about circuity of travel, which our cases and other cases say is not enough to show compensability. He also talks about, we lost the Kelly Inn project. Well, the landowners in this case have failed to show that they had any rights in the property that was the Kelly Inn property. They had a hope and an expectance that the Kelly Inn would develop, but they had no property right. And in fact, if you take that special injury test, you have to show an injury that is different than what's been sustained by the public in general. Well, everyone's been deprived of the Kelly Inn project. Travelers on the interstate who were looking for lodging, the city of Sioux Falls, which might have benefited by sales tax revenue, other people living in the neighborhood that might have liked to have seen commercial development because it might have affected the value of their property. Those are general injuries. It's not the kind of peculiar injury to his land that will sustain a right to compensation. The other argument that he makes, and I've already touched on this a little bit, is that he talks about loss of assemblage right. Well, that's the same thing. He's basically saying, if the Kelly Inn project had gone through, then my property might have been assembled with other property in the neighborhood for additional commercial development. But we have to remember that the right to compensation in eminent domain is grounded in the requirement of a private property right. He didn't have a private property right in the Kelly Inn development. It was an expectancy, and that won't support a right to compensation in eminent domain.
Okay, back to the basic question. How do you get around Hall? I mean, in Hall, one of the things we did was we sent it back because the court didn't look at security of travel in depth enough to determine whether there was a substantial impairment. Now, it seems to me this is exactly the same.
Actually, Your Honor, I disagree with you on that point. If you look at the Hall case, I think it's the second paragraph, that the court observes that, and this is Hall 1, that the Hall property abutted Interstate 90. Hall was complaining about loss of reasonable access to Interstate 90. And so
it was indirect access because Hall's access was to a north-south highway that connected to 90.
It was indirect access, Your Honor, but he still had that reasonable access right as far as the Hall court knew based on the record that it had before it. And so the Hall court observes, you're an abutting landowner, and then the Hall court said, you parties, you both missed the boat because you forgot about the special injury test. That's the test you're supposed to apply, and you didn't. You landowner didn't apply it. Instead, you focused on the government's motives. You DOT didn't apply it. Instead, you talked about loss of traffic. You're supposed to apply the special injury test.
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so that's why it got remanded, is because the court in Hall 1 didn't do what it should have done and what Judge Long did here. Judge Long applied the special injury test. So Hall 1 does not save this case from summary judgment because it's significantly distinguishable. In this case, our circuit court did what he was expected to do by South Dakota law. And that is the distinction that's important here. Now, Mr. Meyer Henry, he also talks about the change in highest and best use of the property. But why did the highest and best use change? He says, well, that's reason for special injury. Actually, that was the argument he made in his brief and down below. Today, what he tells you is there's no viable use of the property. And as I mentioned, the record won't support those new factual assertions. But in addition, why did the highest and best use change? Because of circuity of travel. according to their appraisers. While circuity of travel is not compensable, that alone will not support a claim for compensation. And I'd like to read from one of the cases that the landowner actually urges that the court consider, and that is the Union Elevator case. Union Elevator says, if the impairment of access is merely an added inconvenience that is common to all travelers, it cannot form the basis for compensation. Everyone was deprived of that intersection, not just the landowners in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Engel. Mr. Mayor Henry, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Very briefly and quickly, I would refer to the first issue. The first issue here, is this an eminent domain case or is it a proper exercise of the police power? There has to be a reasonable test. That's what this court, I believe, has told the litigators. And so that's why the first issue that the court below has to decide is a reasonableness issue to get to whether it's an eminent domain case. Has it been a reasonable exercise of the police power? There are some suggestions that this court, or not suggestions, there are rules this court has laid down. One is in Bloom, State Highway Commission versus Bloom, cited in the brief. The landowner has the right, as the owner of land, to access to such land and every part where it abuts upon the highway. This right rests on the ownership of the property, and connected with and appurtenant and subject to the property is therefore a property right. The access is a property right. It is a special private right entirely distinct from the public right, and it's one that pertains not only to the part of the highway abutting the owner's land, but extends sufficiently beyond his own premises to ensure him reasonable facilities for connection with those highways in which he has no special rights. In other words, this is a Bloom case, and it's a Hall case, where the access on 63rd Street, the true access to that property in the before, was the connection of 63rd and Cliff. That was the access, 1 + 2. Bloom says you consider the second part of it.
But is this a Bloom case? Bloom, they cut right through the middle of his land. Bloom was in a butter.
But it's a fact. What it says here, it's part of the reasonableness test, Justice Sinner. Let me, the state has said that there's no evidence. Mr. Cashmitter, I mentioned before, let me read what's in it to you. In the after, the maximally productive use, therefore, is determined to be to raze the building and clear the site to prepare it for redevelopment. Although this redevelopment may be years down the road, it is neither financially feasible or maximally productive to remodel the house or use it in an interim basis. Therefore, it is suggested that the site be cleared in the after. In other words, this test of reasonableness, the reasonableness of the access after, does not support any use but a vacant lot. In Hurley, and this is a case similar to Hurley, remember, and that's why this case is so confusing. If you remember the last paragraph of the judge's decision, he talks about a cloud on the title. This is an inverse condemnation case. It's like Hurley. In Hurley, there was no cloud on the title. The state simply cut off one side, put a median on the other side, remember? And there was an impairment of access, and Hurley allowed recovery, and that's been followed by this court since.
Hurley was also in a butter. Hurley was also in a butter.
Right, the access to the entire street system. So, Bloom is as well, but remember what we just discussed, reasonableness. The question by Mr. Justice Severson points this out. The court has to decide reasonableness. If we have to go to Laverne, Minnesota to interconnect, that's reasonableness. That's evidence. That's what trials are about. Here, the evidence is conflicting. The evidence clearly says, at least for Mr. Cashmitter, he's telling the bank, who has a mortgage on this property, forget it. It doesn't have any use but to sit vacant until sometime in the future. That's far different than what Mr. Cashmere opined in the beginning, which it was a valuable piece of commercial property because it had access, A, onto 63rd Street and 63rd to Cliff. That was its access. To now put the reasonable test to it, is the access now reasonable? The state argues it's always reasonable, but it forgets the fact that, yes, there has to be money spent to improve this dirt road. There did before, and they did after. The difference here, which is in the record, is that you have to have property that can support the improvements.
Is there evidence in the record as to what, is this a 60-foot, 66-foot wide stretch of property now that has hard surface and curb and gutter on it?
No. That's the whole point, one of the whole points of the case. If you read the Schmidt opinion, which is attached as an affidavit, what has to be done is all of these properties have to go together and build a lawful access street, which means part of the slim land and so forth has to be improved.
Well, that was my question to Ms. Engel. Is there evidence in the record that this street is already there? She said it is.
No, she's talking about the extension. The extension that meets up with what used to be the dead end. Remember the map.
So from the dead end back to Cliff is still dirt?
Yes. And what the evidence on the plaintiff's side says is it will always be dirt because the project destroyed the ability to upgrade that whole area. It will never be commercial because the access from the Schlim property, that's why the hotel threw in the towel. The access was gone. It was not reasonable. Therefore, it was a damaging of the property. And then this wrinkle, what other property, other than property in Northside Gardens, which in this case, Justice Zinner, is defined? It's 20 lots. Well, less than that. What other lots in the state of South Dakota are affected by the closure of 63rd Street? None. This is peculiar to Slim's property and to what was the Kelly Inn property. It's now the state's property. Sits vacant. It will sit vacant next to the Slim property vacant, next to the Miller property vacant. Because the only way, and that's why there should be a full investigation of the facts, the only way to improve that street, to make it so you can get off the property to get to this extension, is it has to be economically viable. The state destroyed it. That's the evidence from the claim. We should get a trial to prove that. And there should be findings that I could be arguing with you about, or whether the judge was right or not. And we don't have those, because there was a rush to judgment, just like in Hall.
But we never have findings on summary judgment, and both sides move for summary judgment here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear it.
We don't have findings in summary judgment.
No, I understand that. But you know, this is a constitutional case. For once, the circuit court should recognize there's allegations here, backed up with evidence, that this property owner, as a result of the state's action, I'm going to talk Rupert for a minute. Rupert says, very clearly, if there are actions of the state that cause damage to property and it's unique, the plaintiff recovers. That's the way I read Rupert.
2 minutes.
Here, there's certainly a prima facie case, I'm not sure it's even denied, that the state caused damage to this property in a substantial amount. And if you look at just the facts in the record today, no other lots, save those in Northside Gardens adjacent to 63rd Street, are affected by this.
Okay. So is there a specific, you've talked about reasonableness, is there another specific test? Ms. Engel talks about special injury test. Or are you saying it's just a constitutional issue?
Well, I guess I'm not intelligent enough to divide this up. To me, in order for me to be standing here talking about a constitutional case, I've got to get by that the police power was unreasonable. All right? If it was unreasonable, then we look and see, was it unreasonable to every citizen in the state that we all pay our fair share? Or as Justice Zinner and others of you have written, are these landowners the only one paying the tab? That's part of what I think we intend to prove to the court, if we ever get a trial, is that it's unreasonable. Having passed that, you ask one more question under Rupert. Did everybody suffer this? No. This is a unique, discrete injury to the Schlimm property and a very few others. And that's what we intend to prove. That's what we think the evidence can prove if we get a trial.
Would you?
So they're together is all I'm trying to say.
If we send this back, would you introduce more and new evidence at a bench trial?
Of course. I mean, this goes on and on of how often do we have to try these cases. We'd have someone from the city to say, can anyone get a building permit on any of this property? Answer no. Why? You don't have a street that has proper access. Done. We can't sell the property. Well, we can sell it, but nobody can build on it. And what good does that street do at the end of Northside Gardens if you can't get to that street? Meaning you can't have value in your property because you have to spend $500,000 in order to improve it. This is so unique. All of these cases that go back and forth that we're arguing about, it goes back to reasonable, fact-specific, what this court says. Your tests you have are fine. We got to apply them to the facts, which the trial court didn't allow.
Okay, your time has
expired.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.